Yeah, we're on lecture number 9, and one of my tapes is doing something weird, I don't know.
We're on lecture number 9 of philosophy of religion, and evidence for God, part 3. We're going to start with the cosmological argument, hopefully this lecture or maybe the next lecture after it. After we do evidence for God's existence, we're going to go into the problem of evil. Probably spend a lecture or two on that. And then we'll go over miracles. There's a philosophical argument against miracles, and we need to respond to that. And then we'll talk a little bit about divine sovereignty and human free will, not as much time as we spent on in the soteriology course. And then I'll talk a little bit about the Trinity, because there is some philosophical argumentation that must occur just to show that it is not a contradiction. And so I want to touch on that, although it gets a little bit off of the subject of philosophy of religion. It does involve the Christian religion, and it does involve philosophy, so I figured it would be a good place to put something like that in just to spur on further thought. What I want to do is, as we deal with the cosmological argument, which is the argument from the effect of the universe to its cause, God, I wanted to start with reading. Now, what we have here is, I made a copy from Miller J. Erickson. He edited a work, a 3-volume set called Readings in Christian Theology. And they sell them at CBD, and it's real good to get. I've only got the first volume. I should get the other two, because you're probably never going to be able to get, no matter how rich you are or how well-read you are, you're never going to be able to buy and read every major theologian's works and throughout the history of the church. But in these 3 volumes, Erickson manages to give you kind of a smorgasbord of some of the great thinkers. So like in this one, you get guys like Calvin, you get Luther, you get Paul Tillich, Rudolf Bultmann, Karl Barth, John Calvin, Aquinas, you get B.B. Warfield, Bernard Graham, Charles Hodge, John A.T. Robinson, Augustine, Carl Henry. So you get Louis Burkhoff, you get guys from all different fields of thought, including liberal and neo-Orthodox scholars. It's really in the place, but maybe I should just real quick. The liberal scholars were just the guys that thought that man was basically good, and that the Bible was a human book with errors in it, and that basically Christianity just meant was a book of instruction. The Bible's a book of instruction on how to live a good life. But man is basically good. The neo-Orthodox are not really Orthodox theologians hold to the historic and biblical teachings of the church. The neo-Orthodox theologians said, no, after World War I, it's pretty obvious man isn't inherently good. Man is evil. And so God's got to zap us, like they said, like the Calvinists said, except these guys took it a little further, where the Bible was still a human book, whatever, but it became the Word of God to us as we have an existential encounter with it. And this existential encounter you can't put into words. So keep in mind, the neo-Orthodox and the liberals, sometimes I use the word liberals to cover both. That's what you call liberals with a small L. Liberals with a large L, they have a big difference between them and the neo-Orthodox scholars. And the neo-Orthodox are much closer to the liberals when you compare them with the Orthodox scholars, although they would agree with the Orthodox scholars on the depravity of man. But they would agree with the liberals that the Bible contains errors and things like that. But in Erickson's Readings in Christian Theology, Volume 1, The Living God, he's got a section that quotes word for word. It's just a quotation, an excerpt from Aquinas. Aquinas is 5 ways to prove God's existence. And I want to read those to you. We're not going to comment too much on them. We could do a whole course on this someday. On Aquinas' 5 ways to prove God's existence. But what I want to do, I want you to save this after we read from it. And I want to read from it and just read along to yourself as I do read it. But this way, you know, if somebody ever asks you, have you ever read Aquinas, you can say, yeah, I read a little bit of Aquinas. And I didn't copy it from the Summa Theologica that I have because it's an abridged version, whereas this is taken right from the full five-volume set. So let's take a look at this. Now, I believe three of these, if I remember correctly, three of these are cosmological, and one is a teleological? Let me see. Yeah, one is more of a teleological, and the other one I'm really not sure. So some of it will apply to the cosmological argument that we're going to be discussing today, and some of it won't, but I just want us to look at these five ways. I'm starting at page 127 at the top, and it starts, I answer. This is his answer to the objection that was raised earlier, whether God exists and all, and whether it can be proven. God's existence can be proved in five ways. The first and the clearest proof is the argument for motion. Now, let me say this about motion with Aquinas. Aquinas is really arguing from change, from the existence of change in the universe. It's evidence that there must be an unchanged changer, if you will, a being that is unchanged, an unmoved mover that starts the motion for everything else. And the change, Aquinas would define it as something moved from the state of potentiality to the state of actuality. There was a time when it was possible for us to exist, but we did not actually exist. Well, God had to actualize us. But he takes motion as the most obvious type of change and then uses that as an argument for God's existence. And of course, you get this from Aristotle. The first and clearest proof is the argument for motion. It is certain and in accordance with sense experience that some things in this world are moved. Now that's something that many Greek philosophers, such as Zeno, would not give you. They would say, well, movement is an illusion because you can't prove it. Aquinas would argue, no, that's wrong. Movement is so obvious to us that we don't need to prove it. Yeah, exactly. Now, everything that is moved by something else, since nothing is moved unless it is potentially that to which it is moved, whereas that which moves is actual. To move is nothing other than to bring something from potentiality to actuality, and the thing can be brought from potentiality to actuality only by something which is actual. Thus, a fire which is actually hot makes wood, which is potentially hot, to be actually hot, so moving and altering it. Now it is impossible for the same thing to be both actual and potential in the same respect, although it may be so in different respects.
What does that mean?
But if for something to have the mere potential to exist, even that might break down. But the same thing to be both actual and potential. Okay, we actually exist. And in the sense that Aquinas is talking about, there's a whole other sense that we both are potential beings, but we're also actual beings. But we do have a possibility in our existence. But our potential to exist has been actualized. So we are actual beings, and in the sense he's saying it here. Whereas a potential being would be, it's possible that you would have had a twin brother, but you didn't. So that potential was not actualized. And so he's saying that it's possible for the same thing to be both actual and potential in the same respect. In other words, we either actually exist or we have the potential to exist. The thing is, too, is Aquinas at other times argues almost the exact opposite, but he's just talking about it in a different sense, because he will define us as potential beings at times. because we do have the possibility of non-existence. Yeah. And okay, what is actually hot, oh, he explained himself in the next sentence anyway. What is actually hot cannot at the same time be potentially hot. It's just what I was saying, where what actually exists cannot at the same time be explained as potentially existing.
Right. It doesn't factor
in. Yeah. Although it is potentially cold. Okay, so that's like saying, if we actually exist, we don't potentially exist, though it is, we may have the potential to not exist. It is therefore impossible that, in the same respect, in the same way, anything should be both mover and moved, or that it should move itself. Whatever is moved must therefore be moved by something else. If then that by which it is moved is itself moved, that this also must be moved by something else, and this in turn by something else again. But this cannot go on forever, since there would be then, there would then be no first mover, and consequently no other mover, because secondary movers cannot move unless moved by a first mover, as a staff cannot move unless it is moved by the hand. We are therefore bound to arrive at a first mover which is not moved by anything, and all men understand that this is God. Now, I don't want to get too deep into this, but just give an illustration, like if you got a coffee cup that has the potential to be filled, it can't actualize that potential itself, and so something else has to actualize it. But with our potential to exist, we could not, when we only had the possibility of existing and not the actuality of existing, we obviously could not actualize our own potential to exist. Something else had to actualize. So everything that had the possibility to exist, when it did not exist at one time, had to be actualized by something that already existed. You can't go back forever, so eventually you have to have something that is pure act. It's something with no potential for non-existence, and didn't have to have a potential to exist that was actualized by something else. It just always did exist. Okay? Pure actual existence. And by the way, Aquinas is not arguing, we're going to find out a little bit more about this as we go further, Aquinas is not arguing for cause and effect back in time. He's arguing basically for something that actualizes, well, basically that he's arguing for a sustaining cause of the universe, not a cause of the beginning of the universe. So he's not going back in time, and it was very difficult is. We don't think that way anymore. For modern science, we think backwards in time, cause and effect. He's thinking simultaneous causality, like your reflection in a mirror. But we'll get to that a little later when we break down the three types of cosmological arguments. The second way is from the nature of an efficient cause. We find that there is a sequence of... By the way, these arguments, a lot of guys have slammed these arguments, and so they found all kinds of holes and this and that in them. In actuality, what we need to recognize, Aquinas, his Summa Theologica was not set out to prove God's existence. It was to be a theological textbook. And he only spent... The pages that we're reading right here, these are his five ways to prove God's existence in a multi-thousand page work. So he's just given summaries of the argument. So in actuality, to refute Aquinas would be a lot more difficult than just tearing up these, although others, like Geisler, have put a lot more meat on these arguments and shown how tough they are to refute if you understand it from a Thomistic standpoint. Okay, let's look at the second argument. Okay, the second way is from the nature of an efficient cause. An efficient cause is a cause that causes an effect. That's just real, real simple. Aquinas talks about like five different types of causes, and there's like an instrumental cause of me writing something. The instrument would be the pen. But
whatever creature conceived the idea.
Yeah, the one that made the effect, that used the instrument. that type of thing. But there's even like final causes, such as the goal that something is working towards. The second way is from the nature of an efficient cause. We find that there is a sequence of efficient causes in sensible things. But we do not find that anything is the efficient cause of itself, nor is this possible. For the thing would then be prior to itself, which is impossible. And something cannot cause its own existence. But neither can the sequence of efficient causes be infinite, for in every series, the first efficient cause is the cause of an intermediate cause, and an intermediate cause is the cause of the ultimate cause, whether the intermediate causes be one or be many or only one. Now, if a cause is removed, its effect is removed. Hence, if there were no first efficient cause, there would be no ultimate cause and no intermediate cause. But if the regress of efficient causes were infinite, there would be no first efficient cause. There would, in other words, if you had a chain of cause and effects that was ran on and on infinitely, there would be no cause of that chain.
There would be nobody pushing over the domino.
Yeah. You would need the first domino to fall for the rest to fall. But it's like if all these things are finite causes and effects, then every cause is still an effect. And if you don't have a first cause, the whole series is without. It's like a chain rising up to heaven, and you say, well, how does this link on the chain defy the law of gravity and just hang there? And you say, well, this other link is holding it up. So, well, then what about this other link? How this one's hanging? Well, this other link is holding. Eventually, you've got to find the nail that chain is hooked to, there's nothing holding it up. And it's kind of like when you ground a stereo in a car, you get a stereo and you hook it up in the car, you've got to ground it to metal. And so you decide to take the wire and splice it into another wire and splice it into another wire and splice it into another wire. If you don't eventually ground it into metal, the thing's not going to work. And we've got to ground finite existence with infinite existence, and until you reach the infinite, that won't occur. But if the regress of efficient causes were infinite, there would be no first efficient cause. There would consequently be no ultimate effect and no intermediate causes, but this is plainly false. We are therefore bound to suppose that there is a first efficient cause, and all men call this God. So he is arguing that, in effect, by definition, is caused by something, and finite limited existence needs a cause, and even if you had an infinitely long chain, Aquinas, because he was Aristotelian, he assumed the possibility of an eternal universe philosophically, although theologically he believed that the universe was created by God because God said it. But he said even if you had an infinitely long regress of cause and effects, you would still need an infinite cause to sustain it in existence. Apart from that, there'd be no explanation for it. The third way is from the nature of possibility and necessity. There are some things which may either exist or not exist, since some things come to be and pass away and may therefore be or not be. So you have possible beings which have the possibility of either existing or not existing, like you and I. Now, it is impossible that all of these should exist at all times, because there is at least some time when that which may possibly not exist does not exist. Hence, if all things were such that they might not exist, at some time or other, there would be nothing. But if this were true, there would be nothing existing now, since what does not exist cannot begin to exist unless through something which does exist. If there had been nothing existing, it would have been impossible for anything to begin to exist, and there would now be nothing at all. But this is plainly false, and hence not all existence is merely possible. Something in things must be necessary. What he's saying is, if everything that exists has the possibility of non-existence, okay, then the possibility of everything non-existence, of everything non-existing, would eventually be actualized in the future. But if you go back in the past, it would be actualized in the past,
So in other words, there would be a point in time when there was nothing existing. And since from nothing, nothing comes, something out there must have no possibility for non-existence, and that is the only thing that could ground the existence of everything else. And so he says, hence not all existence is merely possible. Something in things must be necessary. Now, everything which is necessary means it's a necessary being, it must exist. There's no possibility of non-existence. Now, everything which is necessary either derives its necessity from elsewhere or does not. But we cannot go on to infinity with necessary things which have a cause of their necessity any more than with efficient causes, as we proved. We are therefore bound to suppose something necessary in itself, which does not owe its necessity to anything else, but which is the cause of all the necessity of other things. And all men call this God. Now what he's arguing there is there are things that must exist that still their necessity is based on something else, which is like the law of non-contradiction. No matter what universe, what possible universe is actualized, that exists in all possible worlds. Because it's true by definition. And so you have certain things, 1 + 1 = 2 in every possible world, once you understand what one is and what one is and what two is. And so what he's saying is their necessity, they don't contain in themselves the cause of their own necessity, so there's got to be some necessary being which cannot not exist, which needs no cause for its own existence and is the cause of all the other necessary beings that are caused, and also the non-necessary beings which are caused. The fourth way is from the degrees that occur in things, which are found to be more and less good, true, noble, and so on. Things are said to be more and less because they approximate in different degrees to that which is greatest. A thing is the more hot, the more it approximates to that which is hottest. There is therefore something which is the truest, the best, and the noblest, and which is consequently the greatest in being, since that which has the greatest truth is also greatest in being. As is said in Ignatius, of course, from Metaphysics, Aristotle's work. Now that which most thoroughly possesses the nature of any genus is the cause of all that the genus contains. In other words, basically, the greatest, that which most thoroughly possesses goodness must be goodness in itself and the cause of all other goodness. Thus fire, which is most perfectly hot, is the cause of all hot things, as is said in the same passage. There is therefore something which is the cause of the being of all things that are, as well as of their goodness and their every perfection, this we call God. By the way, some of these arguments I've seen paraphrased really, really well, and sometimes it's in the paraphrase form that we see them being more powerful, and this is one of them. I think it gains a lot more power when we see it paraphrased. The fifth way is from the governance of things. We see how some things, like natural bodies, work for men even though they have no knowledge. The fact that they nearly always operate the same way and so as to achieve the maximum good makes this obvious and shows that they attain their end by design and not by chance. Now things which have no knowledge tend towards an end only through the agency of something which knows and also understands, as an arrow through an archer. There is therefore an intelligent being by whom all things are directed to their end. This we call God. I don't think we... Let's read the last two paragraphs. On the first point, as Augustine says, since God is supremely good, he would not allow any evil thing to exist in his works, were he not able by his omnipotence and goodness to bring good out of evil. God's infinite goodness is such that he permits evil things to exist and brings good out of them. We'll spend more time on that when we get to the problem of evil. But on the second point, everything that can be attributed to nature must depend on God as its first cause, since nature works for predetermined end through the direction of a higher agent. Similarly, what is due to purpose must depend on a cause higher than the reason or will of man, since these are subject to change and defect. Anything which is changeable and subject to defect must depend on some first principle which is immovable and necessary in itself, as we have shown. So that just lets you see a little bit of how complex some of the argumentation can be, but that's literally word for word Aquinas's five ways for God's existence, to prove God's existence. Now if you just pull out your textbooks, I'll give you a brief... Did you forget it?
Yeah, that's okay.
I'll give you a brief overview of the three different kinds of cosmological arguments for God's existence. You have the Thomistic, which is Thomas Aquinas's cosmological argument is from the principle of existential causality. What that basically means is he's looking for the sustaining cause of things, the conserving cause, that which keeps everything else in existence. That's the kind of the main focus of his argument. Bonaventure, and also St. Bonaventure, who lived around the same time as Aquinas. Aquinas lived from 1224 to 1274 A.D. And Bonaventure lived from 1221 to 1274. Bonaventure used the Muslim cosmological argument, which was the Kalam cosmological argument, which looked for the cause of the beginning of something's existence. Okay? So with Aquinas, it was the sustaining cause. With Bonaventure, it's the cause of the beginning of something, the Kalam. K-A-L-A-A-M. And with Leibniz, philosopher lived from 1646 to 1716, he used the cosmological argument from sufficient reason. Sufficient reason. I like Leibniz's argument a lot more than Geisler does. Geisler will slam it. See, he's not looking... Aquinas and Bonaventure are looking for a cause in the universe. Leibniz, though, is looking for an explanation in the mind for why things exist. And so Geisler throws Leibniz's argument right into the ontological realm, and I don't really think it belongs there. I'll mention two things. Don't tell Geisler. You're talking about how he gets in big fights with people, but I'll bring up a contradiction that Geisler, he could either make one of the two complaints against Leibniz's argument from sufficient reason, but he can't make both. And he makes both. Well, I'll just bring it up right now. In his philosophy, religion, text, and some of his other works, first off, he says, see, Leibniz argues for God as a self-explained being. Okay? Aquinas and Bonaventure arguing for God basically as an uncaused being. Okay? If we said that God is self-caused, that'd be a contradiction, because then God would have to pre-exist his own existence
in order to cause his own existence to come about. Okay? So, so God is not self-caused, he's uncaused. So Geisler says, there's no real difference between a reason and a cause. They're meaning basically the same thing, or an explanation and a cause. So to call God a self-explained being is the same as a self-caused being. So I agree with William Lane Craig in his Apologetics Introduction. It's not what Leibniz means. There is a difference between an explanation and a cause. Now the thing is, Geisler later on says there's a difference between an explanation and a cause. He says because the explanation is in the mind, whereas the cause is in actual existence, out there in the concrete world, if you will. And so what he's basically saying is, since it's still in the mind, you never get out of the mind to fall for the same accusations as the ontological argument. You might as well throw it in the garbage. So at one time, guys were saying, it's not a cause, it's a reason or an explanation which occurs in the mind, therefore it's invalid. But then a few pages later, Geisler says, hey, look, let's face it, there's no real difference between a cause or a reason or an explanation. Therefore, to say that God is self-explained means the same thing as God being self-caused. And to be a self-caused being is impossible because you'd have to pre-exist your own existence in order to cause your own existence. In actuality, when Leibniz says that God is self-explained, all he means is that you don't have to look outside of the being of God to explain his existence. He contains his own explanation for his existence. And what is that explanation? That explanation is that God is uncaused. Okay? So, God is self-explained, is a self-explained being because he's uncaused. So it's just a different way of saying the same thing as Aquinas and Bonaventure are saying. In fact, when you read Aquinas, Aquinas refers to God as being self-existent. In other words, he exists by his own power. But that does not mean that he caused his own existence. And so I think guys was a little bit too hard on Leibniz. I think all three of these arguments are pretty good arguments.
So God is self-explained, but
we are explained by another. Yeah. See, and in fact,
because we're dependent.
Yeah. In fact, let me read a basic way. If you ever get John Hick's book, The Existence of God, which he edited, they've got in there the transcript of the debate from between Father Copleston, Frederick Copleston, and Bertrand Russell on God's existence. Which, by the way, Bertrand Russell basically got his guitar kicked out of him on that day. But I like the way Copleston talks about it, too. He says, if a man refuses to come to the chessboard and sit down, you can never ever hold him in checkmate. And what he's saying is not that we're not better chess players than them. It's not that we're better chess players than them. It's just that they won't play, yeah. Let's take a look first then at Leibniz's argument from sufficient reason. Is that the one right there?
Yeah, give me a second.
Sure. And in fact, we could just... Okay. Leibniz's cosmological argument from sufficient reason says basically this: there is a sufficient reason for everything that exists. Makes you wonder, well, that's pretty tough to prove, but think about accepting the denial of it, that things would exist for no particular reason at all. You could say, you could be locked up in a room with a guy, and then the police open the door, and they find a knife in his back, and he would say, well, it just got there. I didn't have anything to do with it, and my fingerprints just got on the knife, and we expect to find a sufficient reason for everything that exists. the existence of some beings is explained by something other than themselves. For instance, my existence, you need my parents to explain how I got here. Joseph Fernandez and Angelina Minichino got together and had a baby boy and called him Phil. The air that I breathe, my existence would not be no explanation for it without the air that I breathe, the food and water that I need, and right on down the line, I'm a dependent being, a contingent being, whose existence is explained by something else. But the collection of all these beings that need, that are explained by something else, the collection of all these beings itself needs an explanation. An infinite regress of sufficient reasons is impossible, because then there would be no explanation at all. Now let me say this. This argument you can end. There are some that say, well, the universe is just here and that's all there is to it, like Bertrand Russell, or the Jean-Paul Sartres, who would say, well, there's no explanation for why we exist. It just, you know, we're just thrown into existence without a reason. But I think that they could be attacked that nobody can live that way. There's no way you can live like there's no purpose and no meaning to life. And so I think it's a pretty strong premise, though it's tough to prove. It's much tougher to disprove. An infinite regress of sufficient reasons is impossible, because then there would be no explanation for existence at all. Therefore, there must exist a being who contains within itself the reason for its own existence. That's the self-explained being. There must exist a being who contains within itself the reason for its own existence, and then this being explains the existence of itself and all other beings. Okay? Eventually, you have beings whose existence are explained by other beings. Eventually, you have to arrive at a being who contains within itself the explanation for its own existence. What is the explanation for God's existence? It's contained within himself, because he is, by nature, an uncaused being, an eternal being that has no beginning and no end. His essence is to exist. Now, Aquinas argues from existential causality, which is arguing for the sustaining cause of the universe, not necessarily the beginning cause of the universe. Aquinas argues as follows. And by the way, I'm referring more to my breakdowns of these arguments than Geisler's, because I think sometimes he tends to make them sound even more complex, and I'm sure he presents them in a more solid manner than I do, but sometimes understanding doesn't take place. Aquinas' argument, cosmological argument for existential causality, would run like this. Beings exist which are dependent on other beings for their continuing existence. So he's not looking for an explanation for their existence. He's looking for other beings. He's looking for some other being as the cause of their continuing existence, so their sustaining cause. Dependent beings cannot be the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of other dependent beings. For instance, so now here, we're not talking about parents, because you can live after your parents are dead, so that's real clear that your existence, your continuing existence doesn't depend on that. Aquinas isn't looking for the initial cause, he's looking for the continuing. But if air, food, and water themselves are dependent beings that need a cause for their continuing existence, then they cannot be the ultimate cause. Dependent beings cannot be the ultimate cause of the continuing existence of other dependent beings. You've got to find a totally independent being. Adding dependent beings never gives us an independent being. no matter how many dependent beings we add up, we still have a whole group of beings that are dependent on something else for their existence. The ultimate cause for the continuing existence of all dependent beings, therefore, must be an independent being. In other words, a being that depends on nothing outside of itself for its own existence. So it's a totally independent being that is not dependent on anything else for its existence. Modern proponent of this would be Norman Geisler. Some of his argumentation is complex, but he'll break it down, spend 30, 40 pages. His philosophy of religion, I heard from Habermas that Geisler likes his argument, his cosmological argument in Christian apologetics, in his Christian apologetics work more than in his philosophy of religion book. So if you want the kind of the vintage Geisler, go to the Christian apologetics. Geisler used to teach at Liberty, so he and Habermas did dialogue face-to-face on the subject. Now, Bonaventure used the Kalam cosmological argument, which argues for the beginning, the cause of the beginning of something's existence. He argued that whatever had a beginning needs a cause. The universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. An infinite regress is impossible, therefore the cause of the universe must be eternal. Now, the modern proponent of this is William Lane Craig. We could put some more meat on this. Okay, whatever had a beginning needs a cause. That's pretty obvious because you can't have something just pop into existence out of nothing. Nothing is nothing, therefore nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. Therefore, if something had a beginning, something out there had to cause it to come into existence. The universe had a beginning. That premise, you can go to the second law of thermodynamics for scientific confirmation of this premise. Second law of thermodynamics says that even though the amount of energy in the universe remains constant, the amount of usable energy in the universe is running down. As energy changes forms, it becomes less and less usable. So that the universe is heading in a direction where eventually all the energy in the universe will have been used up. The universe will die. But that means if you go backwards in time, eventually you reach a point where all the energy in the universe is usable. So in other words, the universe is winding down. It's going to have an end. If it's winding down, it had to be wound up and it had to have a beginning. Many people have used the Big Bang model to try to support that. The Big Bang model, however, doesn't hold as much weight as the second law of thermodynamics does. And yet, there's some definite, it's in need of some tremendous explanations to try to allow it to hold any water. But whatever had a beginning needs a cause, the universe had a beginning. The best argumentation for the beginning of the universe is probably philosophical, and that is in the fact that the, in order for the universe to be eternal, there would have to be an infinite number of moments in time. Because no matter how far you go back, you never reach the beginning because there is no beginning if it was eternal. But the problem with that is if you had infinite moments of time, you would never reach the present moment. Because in order to reach it, you would have to traverse an actual infinite set of moments, and it's impossible to traverse an infinite set, because no matter how many moments you traversed, you would still have an infinite number more of moments to cross. And so there had to have been a first event. I think we'll leave it at that. I don't want to get into whether it's possible to have an actual infinite set. We just argue that it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite set, and that gets a lot more complex to go further than that. But we know the universe had to have a beginning. In fact, maybe we should, just for the sake of bringing up, in fact, I'll let this cassette wind down and we'll pick it up right in the next lecture.